Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. The Supreme Court of Texas is honored to sit today for the first time in Hillsboro, Texas, at the courthouse of the county seat of Hill. For 6 years, we have been, pursuant to constitutional amendment, traveling twice a year to various parts of the state to hear oral arguments. Generally, we have also visited with students and with bar leaders and court officials as we make these visits. Due to budget cuts, this will be the last Supreme Court road trip in the foreseeable future. And we think it altogether fitting that we end here in Hillsboro, which is the home to so many distinguished and prominent Texas political leaders. And the one that's nearest and dearest to our court as an institution, of course, is Bob Calvert, a member of our court for 22 years and Chief Justice for the last 11 of those years. Of course, many of us served in state government with Bob Bullock, and we also knew former Attorney General Crawford Martin, and it is a real pleasure for us to be here. Unfortunately, Justice Priscilla Owen was not able to be here. She's in Washington attending to some sort of business. But the remainder of the court is here, and we are pleased to welcome each of you, particularly the students from Hill College and from Abbott High School, Blum High School, Bynum High School, Covington High School, Hillsboro High School, Hubbard High School, Itasca High School, the Mount Calm School, Whitney High School, and West High School. And we'll have a chance to visit with some of you later. We had a settlement today, leaving us with only one case to hear. No, we didn't have a settlement. We had a dismissal, and the case became moot. But we are left with one case to hear on today's docket, and that is Provident Life and Accident Insurance Company versus Dr. James Knott. This case originated in Dallas County and was appealed to the 11th Court of Appeals in Eastland. We will allow 20 minutes for each side, the petitioner and the respondent, to present oral argument. And the petitioner may reserve a portion of that 20 minutes for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. So we are now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Provident Life versus Knott.
May it please the court, Mr. Andrew Whitaker will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The trial court correctly entered summary judgment in Provident's favor, finding as a matter of law that Dr. Knott was not totally disabled from his occupation of gynecologist. In its published opinion, the Court of Appeals acknowledged this court's earlier ruling, or recent ruling, in the Cowan case, that insurance policies are interpreted like other types of contracts, that where terms are defined, that is, given a specific meaning within the four corners of an agreement, those defined terms should be interpreted as written. But after acknowledging those concepts, the court then went on to completely rewrite the terms of the policies between Provident and Dr. Knott by taking the definition of total disability, which in the policies covers against the inability to do the duties of his occupation, and instead replace that definition with a common law definition covering Dr. Knott's inability to do any substantial portion of the work connected with his occupation. If the Court of Appeals is correct, and if its ruling is allowed to stand, the court has rewritten not only the total disability policies between Provident and Dr. Knott, but it has by extension rewritten all of the occupation-specific policies in force in the state of Texas by ignoring the terms of the policy itself and replacing it with this common law definition. In addition to ignoring the terms of the policies between Provident and Dr. Knott, the Court of Appeals also, erroneously we believe, failed to follow numerous recent decisions from this court interpreting the terms of the policies or terms of a contract as written, reading the contract in such a way as to give meaning to all of the policy's terms, and rejecting as unreasonable any reading of the policy that renders any part of the contract meaningless.
Mr. Whitaker, how do you distinguish this particular fact situation where the courts in the early 1920s, at least, starting in the 1920s, looked at language pretty similar to this and said that, in fact, we're not going to require a person to be totally shut down. How do we determine how much a person is supposed to be incapable of performing his daily duties?
Well, Your Honor, I think the natural starting point is the terms of the policy that have been agreed upon. The Supreme Court in the Murphy case made it clear that before you do a public policy type of analysis, which I think is what the Court of Appeals did here, you first have to look at the policies itself and see what the result is under those policies. Here we have the interplay, which was, we believe, was absent in the majority of the cases relied upon by the Court of Appeals, of definitions of total disability and partial disability.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, are you going to require, bottom line, in your definition, that a person just can't perform any duty?
We believe, Your Honor, that the definitions read together in the Provident policies provide that the individual must be unable to do all of the duties of his occupation. Okay.
The language specifically says unable to perform the duties.
It does, Your Honor.
Our earlier cases say we have to give that a reasonable construction. You're asking us to put in all duties or any duties.
I don't know that we're asking the court to rewrite it. We're just asking the court to find that in order to be totally disabled, somebody must be unable to do the duties of the occupation. And whenever you look at the definition of partial or residual disability, Your Honor, which cover against the inability to perform one or more of the important daily business duties or provide for a loss of time.
But doesn't that comport with our early definitions? Because the early definition said unable to do a substantial portion of those duties, which is more than partial disability definition, which is one or more.
Well,
they seem to dovetail nicely here. I don't see how they don't.
Well, I don't believe, Your Honor, that the earlier cases that the Court of Appeals relied on involved definitions of partial or residual disability. And in fact, they involved entirely different definitions than the definition before the court now. For example, in the Tate and Johnson cases, those cases involved any occupation definitions.
No, I understand there are differences in the policies, but based on your plain meaning argument, when this policy was drafted, we presume that the drafter, the insurance company, knew the common law definition of total disability. And there's nothing here, by saying unable to perform the duties of your occupation, there's nothing here that ostensibly seems to try to do something different than that.
Well, other than the presence of the definition right below it, a partial disability that covers against the inability to perform one or more. And I think if
you're saying those are inconsistent, it's hard for me to see how one or more versus substantial is different. I mean, it's the same.
Well, I think that, frankly, Your Honor, I don't know that there's really been any discussion in the cases of what substantial necessarily means. And I think that's one of the problems, that if the Court of Appeals decision is allowed to stand, there are going to be policies across the state that are going to be rewritten on the notion of, if you are unable to perform a substantial portion of the work, is that a qualitative, is that a quantitative? We just don't know.
Here's my problem with your argument. Had the doctor come into Provident and bought a policy and said, I only want total disability, then it seems to me your argument is he'd be entitled to get that coverage here under a long line of Texas cases. But because he got additional coverage for something less than total disability, which presumably that's a more expensive policy, he ends up getting less.
I respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. I think by including most disabilities, Your Honor, tend to be of a short-term or temporary or partial nature. And by buying partial or residual coverage, the individual is actually getting additional coverage by being able to recover benefits if he's only able to work part-time, or if he's able to, say, do some of what he used to do but not all of what he used to do. Under the policies, he gets benefits under the Provident policies that are at issue here. But if he had not elected to get those cut, those additional coverages, then he would not be covered against the inability if he was only working part-time, for example, or if there was some duty that he was unable to do.
Mr. Whitaker, part of the, let's assume that part of the function of this doctor for this business, for this PA, is billing, for example. And he can't perform surgery anymore because of back injuries, et cetera, but he can do some of the administrative tasks. Under your argument today, if he's able to do that small portion of administrative task for the job, would he be totally disabled, given that he can't do any of the medical operations?
Am I understanding the court's question that a determination has been made that those administrative or billing types of duties
are part of his occupation,
constitute a duty of the occupation?
Yes.
Okay. Assuming that they do constitute a duty of the occupation, it is going to be something that makes that occupation what it is. And by virtue of his ability to do that duty, which means he's going into the same office, doing some of the same things that he used to do, and presumably deriving some sort of financial benefit from doing that, then in fact he is not going to be totally disabled.
In that regard, Mr. Whitaker, let me add, it seemed that one of the concerns of our early cases was not so much that there wasn't other coverage for partial disability or the like, but that to take the statement of total disability to mean not being able to perform any of the duties of the occupation would virtually make that provision worthless. It didn't cover anything because you, I think as some would say, you'd have to be dead before you'd be disabled. In that regard, in this case, wouldn't that concern still apply, even if the policy still provides coverage for partial disability or residual disability? Wouldn't that concern still apply to the total disability if the court thought that the way it was to be literally read meant that if you could perform any function of being a doctor, then you'd have no coverage? And as a result, that provision would never be reached, short of the doctor being an invalid in bed and not literally being able to function at all.
Well, I think one difference, Your Honor, between the older cases and this case is the focus on the word duties. And that is,
that provision would never be reached short of the doctor being an invalid in bed and not literally being able to function at all.
Well, I think one difference, Your Honor, between the older cases and this case is the focus on the word duties. And that is, it focuses on what it is that makes that occupation what it is. Certainly, it is not difficult at all to come up with circumstances under which Dr. Knott would qualify as totally disabled, but still be able to do some of the tasks that he used to do.
Well, he could consult in gynecology. He could be a quadriplegic in a wheelchair and not even be able to speak, but if he could tap out the notes on a typewriter and look on a video screen, he could consult. And that's one of the duties of being a gynecologist. So he would not be totally disabled from the reading of the statute, but he'd be partially disabled because he could not perform one or more duties.
Well, admittedly, that's an extreme example, Your Honor, of one possible result. But I think that what's important to note about the consulting aspect of it is Dr. Knott advised us that consulting was one of his duties. But I think distilled to its essence, the duties of the occupation of gynecologist may well properly defined not include that. That is, there may be a way, and certainly an insurance company who takes that position, that that a doctor who is physically disabled from doing any aspect of what he used to do, other than possibly typing on a typewriter or a computer, denies that claim at its peril, basically. And I think one way around that is to seek refuge in the policy, to say what are the duties of this occupation? What makes the occupation of gynecologist what it is? And I don't think there's any question that performing surgeries and seeing patients are going to qualify under any set of circumstances as the duties of his occupation. And what we have here is a doctor, Dr. Knott, who at all times has been able to see patients and at all times has been able to perform at least some types of surgeries.
I'm unclear what your position is. If he can't perform some essential duty of the occupation, then what is your position? He can, there let's just make it easy, the A, B, C, D, and E, and he can do A, B, C, and D, but he can't do E, and you can't be what he is if you can't do E. Is that total disability or not?
Well, I would think that that is not necessarily this case. Because
I want to ask you about that in a minute. But first of all, with respect to the definition, if there is an essential thing that you can't do, but you could do other things, which maybe are essential or non-essential, but there's one essential thing you can't do, then does that meet your definition of total disability?
I would think if properly analyzed, Your Honor, there was one duty, and the doctor was unable to do that duty.
No, there's multiple duties. But one of them makes the job what it is.
The duties from which the other duties flow.
Yes.
Orthopedic surgeon who cannot do surgery.
Right.
I would think that doctor would be totally disabled, Your Honor.
And then there is no dispute in this record that he cannot do some things. Is that true?
There is no dispute, Your Honor, that there are certain, for purposes of summary judgment, that there are certain surgical procedures that Dr. Knott is unable to do.
And so now we're talking about how broad is the category of the occupation, perhaps. And because if any one of those surgical procedures was essential to his occupation, then your position would be he's totally disabled.
Well, I would analyze it, Your Honor, in terms of duties. And I would, again, rely on what the policy says about that term. And the policy says duties. So I would analyze surgery as being duties. If Dr. Knott is unable to perform certain types of surgical procedures, but can, and we in fact know he performed other types of surgical procedures, he is not unable to perform that duty, therefore not totally disabled.
But if we define the occupation as microsurgery, we define it down so that it includes, so that one essential part of the occupation is something he can't do, you would say he was disabled.
I mean, assuming for purposes of your hypothetical, Your Honor, that his occupation entailed the performance of only one type of surgery, which he could not do, from which all of his other duties flowed, then I think duties of his occupation, he is unable to perform those because surgery is the duty of that occupation. And that's why I think I tend not to want to get too sidetracked on, you know, the extreme case of the person who could do the, you know, shuffle the paperwork or, you know, clip documents together, because I don't think properly analyzed that is a duty of that occupation. It may be something that he did, but it's not going to qualify as a duty of that occupation.
How would you define the duty of the occupation? Is that a question of law, or does the jury decide that?
Well, I think if the facts are undisputed as to what the individual was doing, I think it becomes a question of law. I mean, here...
Again, to follow up on Justice Heck's question, at what level, how far down do you define what the duties are? Do you define categories of surgery, or do you divide it surgery, consultation, administrative? At what, I mean, how do you come up with categories of duties?
Well, in the first instance, we check with the plaintiff. And one of the forms that we send a plaintiff at the time, or an insured at the time they want to submit a claim, we ask them, list the duties of your occupation. Here on that form and during his deposition, Dr. Knott repeatedly identified having four duties: surgery, seeing patients, consulting with physicians, and performing administrative duties. For purposes of this analysis, we will adopt his listing of his duties as being the duties
so
that he provided.
What if the surgery duty you did perform, 100% of what you did was the type of microsurgery, and after the disability you can't do that anymore, but you retool yourself and do some other type of surgery?
He would at best, Your Honor, qualify as residual or partial, which covers against the inability to do one or more of your material duties. So if Dr. Knott was unable to do the surgeries that he used to do and was suffering an income loss, he would potentially qualify as residually disabled. And if he's lost income, you know, during the changeover to his new type of surgery, he would be entitled to residual disability benefits up to age 65.
You're not saying that he has to be unable to perform all duties in order to be totally disabled?
We are saying, Your Honor, that due to the presence of the definitions of partial and residual, that he must be unable to perform the duties, which means all.
Well, then can you explain your footnote in your petition, footnote 9, which says that you are not making that argument. Are you taking a different position now?
That footnote was put there by me. That footnote was in error, and I apologize for the court. When we were before the trial court, we said he needed to be unable to perform all. We said that in our summary judgment motion, summary judgment brief, and that was what our corporate representative testified as well. So that is solely a situation of my making, Your Honor, and I apologize for that.
Let me just understand so I can put it in simple terms so I can understand it. Michael Jordan goes and buys a total disability policy. He gets unfortunately hurt in the car, and he can't dribble. But he can shoot free throw shots, and he can shoot jump shots from any place on the court, and hit just as well, but he can't dribble. Is he not entitled to any...
Well, I'd say...
Be totally disabled?
I think you would define... I think that would go back to Justice's Hecht question earlier. If he is unable to perform one aspect that prevents him from doing that occupation in its entirety, if he could not dribble, for example, then he is unable. But I don't think, Your Honor, in that situation that you would parse duties down to include, you know, every little single thing that he did as a basketball player, because you would look at what the duties of the occupation truly entail, and the duty of the occupation is playing basketball.
Can we take your company's payments from 1996 to 1998 as an admission that his condition at that time was total disability?
I don't think so, Your Honor. First of all, under this
court... Let me expand that question a little bit more before you answer it. Did Provident seem to send mixed signals to Dr. Knott? That your position is there was denial sent in 1986.
Correct.
Then there was a waiver of premiums from 89 to 95 suggesting total disability. There's agreement to pay Dr. Knott from 1986 to 1989, and suggesting total disability according to Dr. Knott's position. Was Provident sending mixed signals?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what Provident was doing was bending over backwards in a customer service move to provide benefits that would not otherwise, that Dr. Knott would not otherwise be entitled to. We let Dr. Knott know in February 1986 that because he was working on a part-time basis, within that 90-day elimination period, he was not totally disabled. But to bend over backwards to Dr. Knott, we added a residual disability rider, which he had declined to apply for, that enabled him to get benefits. And so for that first three-year period, we were providing benefits that he was not, would not have been entitled to absent our good faith decision to add a residual disability rider. In 1991, when we resumed billing Dr. Knott for the premiums, Dr. Knott complained of that decision, and we sent him a letter, which is in the record, where we said, we don't think you're entitled to the waiver of your premiums, but as a customer service move, we will agree to go ahead and do that. And that's what we agreed, that's what we did from that point forward. Then returning to Justice Phillips' question, from 1996 to 1998, Dr. Knott advised us on his initial claim statement that he was not working. I think now we know a little bit more about Dr. Knott's activities during that 1996 to 1998 time period, that if we had been, if we knew then what we know now, we might have had a different result there. But we went ahead and took Dr. Knott at his word and went ahead and paid him for that entire period. But we paid him for that period because he told us that his disability arose after his 65th birthday, which meant that he was only entitled to the 24 months of total disability benefits at that point.
Mr. Whitaker, you've explained what you believe is a good motive for bending over backwards, as you've called it. Notwithstanding your motive, does that still create a potential reasonable difference of opinion as to what Providence conduct constituted? Was it a denial that there was total disability, or could a reasonable fact finder have looked at the report and said, irrespective of what may be, in your terms, a good motive, that the signal was sent that it was not a denial of total benefits?
I think, Your Honor, we have been consistent since the letter in February of 1986, telling Dr. Knott that if he is going into the office as a gynecologist, doing some, if not all, of what he used to do as a gynecologist, he's not totally disabled. And the fact that we took steps to give Dr. Knott the benefit of the doubt, I don't think changed that fundamental premise. You know, in terms of waiving the premiums or in terms of providing residual disability benefits, those were done by agreement to accommodate Dr. Knott. And in fact, the fact that Dr. Knott did not receive total disability benefits from 1986 through to 1996, I think speaks volumes about the message that Provident was trying to send at that point in time.
Do you think there are limits on what Provident could have done after sending that 1986, I think what you described as a denial letter, that would have taken Providence's position from arguably not one of agreeing there's total disability to one of there is total disability. In other words, are the things Providence could have done after sending that letter that would have meant that de facto it was not in agreement with the letter that there was total disability?
Well, no question. I mean, instead, in response to Dr. Knott's complaint about that letter, we could have said, you're right, Dr. Knott, you are totally disabled, and we will resume paying you total disability benefits.
Short of that, is there a line that this court can look at as to where to draw Providence's statement as compared to its conduct?
Well, I think the only aspect of conduct, Your Honor, that I think is inconsistent with the position announced in February 1986 is the point made by Justice Phillips regarding the payment of benefits in 1996 to 1998. I think the other events, when they're analyzed in the context in which they arose, were not a admission by Providence that Dr. Knott was totally disabled at all. I think to the contrary, they were saying, we think you are not totally disabled, but we are going to go ahead and accommodate you in this way. And I don't think it's good policy or good result to punish Provident or somehow a stop Provident at this point by virtue of those good faith decisions that resulted in benefit to Dr. Knott.
Tell me how you think this opinion should read. We should say that the plain language of the policy says that you have to be unable to perform the duties of your occupation, meaning all duties of your occupation.
Well, I don't know necessarily, Your Honor, that the court has to reach that to reach that point in this opinion. And let me tell you why. The policies do cover against the duties. Okay, duties appears in the partial, total, and residual definition. And it is undisputed that there is no one single duty that Dr. Knott is unable to perform.
Depending upon how you perform, how you define duty.
Well, Dr. Knott told us that surgery is one of his duties. And the policy does not cover against the inability to do procedures. It covers against the inability to do duties. And we have a surgical log that shows that Dr. Knott performed more surgeries in the 7 months after the plane crash than he did.
I'm trying to figure out how you would write this opinion as you're unable to perform the duties of your occupation. Surgery is a duty of the occupation. Undisputed evidence is you could perform some surgery. Therefore, plain language, no total disability.
That would be fair, Your Honor. And I don't think the court has to go any further than that if it is so inclined.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ben Martin will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I would like to take this opportunity, getting off of my original outline, to address, if I could, some of the questions that the court had this morning for Mr. Whitaker. I would first address Justice Wainwright's inquiry regarding the mixed messages and the mixed signals that Dr. Knott was given. In fact, he was given mixed signals. Back in 1986, he was put on waiver of premium. Waiver of premium, in accordance with the policy definition, means that they are considering him to be totally disabled. What they additionally did was, in their internal documents, had indicated he is to put on permanent waiver of premium. This was 1990-1991, at that time period, on both policies, because he was had a continuing total disability. At the same time, they had initially, and I'll talk about this in a minute, Your Honor, the initial denial, which we take the position was certainly not an outright denial, was withdrawn effectively a month later when Providence said, you really don't owe us this money back that we previously last month said you do, because the only reason could be because we're putting you on waiver premium, we consider you to be totally disabled. At the same time, they give him an illusory benefit. The illusory benefit, in effect, takes away from him the conception that he can, in fact, or perception that he can, in fact, do anything. because they're saying, what we're going to do is we're going to consider you totally disabled and we're going to give you this residual disability rider, effectively paying you for being partially disabled, yet at the same time telling you you are totally disabled.
And he didn't complain for 10 years about that.
He didn't complain for 10 years, Your Honor. There is no evidence as to whether or not he is taking the position that back in 1986 he should have.
My only point is the estoppel argument can work both ways. He took the partial disability payment and didn't say anything about it for 10 years, so there's some level of estoppel there as well, I think, if we're going to go an estoppel route.
Well, we do not think that Provident can put an insured in the position of giving him an illusory benefit. Even though he is a doctor, he is an educated individual. They are in a superior position to tell Dr. Knott, for instance, look, we're going to give you this benefit. It was, in fact, not a benefit. It was a detriment, because Dr. Knott was indeed entitled to total disability benefits if, in fact, he was totally disabled. So we are not saying that there is evidence that conclusively establishes or otherwise establishes, because it's not an issue in this case, what his disability was back then, which is why we take the position on the statute of limitations issue that he didn't file suit until 1996 or 98 because of the fact that at that point in time we said, yes, he can no longer do anything effectively.
Let me ask you how, if you look at, it strikes me that the old cases where we interpret this language didn't have partial disability definitions in them. They were total disability policies.
Sure.
I'm having a hard time figuring out how we are to construe both of these together, which admittedly would have to do. Can you tell me what the difference is between inability to perform one or more important daily business duties versus a substantial portion of the work?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, the cases all indicate that it is a jury question, first of all.
I'm talking about legal definition.
Right.
How the facts line up under them, but
right.
Just conceptually, what's the difference between
absolutely.
A substantial portion of the work and one or more important daily business duties?
I think they're completely compatible and completely consistent. One, the jury could think, okay, what is one or more important daily tasks or important tasks of the occupation, which is the partial definition. There's certainly a major qualitative difference, I believe, between one or more important daily tasks and then the substantial or material duties of an occupation. For instance, in this very case, one or more daily tasks might be some administrative tasks that he cannot do. He may be considered partially disabled for that. But I would point to the fact that the evidence, contrary to Provident's position in this case, is the fact that there is a multitude of surgical and non-surgical things he cannot do. The evidence, as pointed out in the brief, is he can't do any microsurgery. He could have done it before. He can't do any obstetrics that he was considering going back into because of Dr. Kuhn's withdrawal from the partnership. He can't do most laser surgery. He was unable at all to perform any vaginal surgery, and he can't do any surgeries involving bending.
Let me ask you this question. If he was able to do any sort of surgery before that required a lot of physical activity, and after the injury he was somehow precluded from doing very physical sort of surgery and could only do microsurgery, which was much more lucrative, and he ended up tripling his income, under your argument, he would still be entitled to total disability for the rest of his life.
Well, total disability is not income determinative. So that would be the first response. The second response is, if the court is looking at the facts of this specific case, in fact, the opposite is true with regard to his microsurgery.
The argument, I mean, it could work the other way. It could work the way I've opposed it.
The other way being, could he make more money and still be totally disabled, essentially?
Full time in surgery, doing a different type of surgery, making three times the money. still be drawing total disability?
I would think that would be a possibility. However, I do not think that that it would be a very good case to put in front of a jury. I mean, truthfully, that's why I believe that it should be a jury question, because of those very case of that very case. I don't know that in a matter of law he would be totally disabled under those circumstances.
Every case is a jury case in your view.
Every case, unless it is conclusively established.
But you just said it couldn't be.
It couldn't be conclusively established. I think it would be very difficult. I think it would be very difficult for a situation to arise where, on either side, an individual could be considered totally disabled or conclusively established that he was not totally disabled, especially when the fact issues are presented in this case. And
when
a person
goes back to work after an accident and is doing something like what he was doing before, physician here, and is fully occupied and making more money than he was making before, you don't usually think of that as totally disabled.
Well,
under any definition.
I can say this, that in this particular case, there were occasions where he was making more money. There were occasions where he was making less money. In fact, the insurance company paid him very few months for this residual disability because, in fact, he was making slightly more money than the 20% loss that he was incurring. He had, at times, greater than a 20% loss in income, and in fact, they paid him the residual disability benefits.
But it seems to me your argument says that if, unfortunately, as a result of the plane accident, he had been crippled and really could not show up for work, he would be in the same position vis-a-vis this policy with respect to the benefits as he is if he can do everything except perhaps one kind of surgery.
If the one kind of surgery is considered to be in accordance with Supreme Court law for 80 years now.
But doesn't that strike you as odd that a total disability would encompass everything from you can't move, as Judge Enoch said earlier, you're almost dead, to you can do everything you could do before except maybe just this little bit?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree for the reason that I think that it is inconsistent for the definition of partial disability to encompass everything except laying on your back, unable to do anything. That's what I think is more bothersome.
Let me follow up on Judge Snyder's hypothetical. If you had Michael Jordan who couldn't dribble, he can no longer play basketball, then he goes and plays baseball and signs a great big contract to play baseball, does he draw full total disability?
I don't know. I don't know. But I will say this, that I think the chances of Michael Jordan not being able, for a physical reason, to not be able to dribble and still be able to be a Major League Baseball player would be so rare it shouldn't work as a disservice to an individual like Dr. Knott, because of the circumstances in this case, those aren't even close. What if I could respond to the example? I believe the example would be if Michael Jordan couldn't dribble, and therefore dribbling is a part of the professional basketball game such that I suspect he couldn't play at all. But he could go play exhibitions for a few minutes and make money playing exhibitions at a high school gym or college gyms, for instance. He would probably make a lot of money, I suspect. Michael Jordan would, but he's not able to dribble. I think in that certain circumstance, Michael Jordan certainly should be entitled, because he has lost any substantial material duty, he should be entitled to recover his total disability benefits for which he paid, and in this case, for which Dr. Knott paid for many, many, many years.
Do you agree, Mr. Martin, that your client would have been better off only to buy a total disability policy?
Absolutely. However, with this particular insurance, with Provident, if they acted as they did in this case, it wouldn't matter if he bought a total disability policy. I suspect they could have, again, given him, to use the term that Provident likes to use, a residual disability rider. In fact, and then could take that residual rider on the total disability policy and use it against him, just as they're using it against him today, and just as they've used it against him throughout.
What? Give us an example of, within the confines of this fact, of what you believe partial disability would have been.
Okay. From memory, when he filled out the duties of his occupation, what they were for prior to his plane crash, I believe there was something like 30% was a certain type of microsurgery. 30% was maybe another type of laser surgery, for instance, which I believe is different actually than microsurgery. A certain percentage was endoscopic procedures, and then a smaller percentage were administrative duties. A partial disability might be that he could see, and he was seeing, I think, 25 patients. This is a very good example, I think. He was seeing, I think, 25 patients prior to his plane crash where he broke his back. And afterwards, he may have been able, if he had been able to see, because of the fatigue involved, he may have been able to see 12 patients or 15 patients. And he was still able to do his surgeries. But you know, maybe if he did one surgery a day, an hour and a half surgery, he could still do that. But because of the fatigue involved, he could see only a certain number of patients as opposed to the number he could for. I believe that would be a situation where he could still see patients, couldn't see as many of them, and that would be, I believe, a case where he could be entitled to partial disability as opposed to total disability payments.
Under those same facts, he could also be totally disabled.
If the jury were to consider that the patients, that the numbers of patients that he was unable to see in his physical condition, and the with the medical testimony that would be at hand, the jury certainly could. And I believe should be able to make a determination as to whether or not that is a material or a substantial duty of his job.
You said a moment ago
that you are
there
in a difficult situation in this case, it appears to me. On the one hand, your client would like to have the total disability determination occur prior to him turning age 65, because then he would get lifetime benefits. On the other hand, if that determination goes back to prior to August 1995, when your client turned 65, then you may have a problem with the statute of limitations, which the Court of Appeals talked about. Since there's no precipitating event in 1995 or occurrence that led to the disability claim in 1996, you've got to kind of bridge that gap. And it is a tightrope walk. You walk that rope?
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, that it's a tightrope. I feel confident.
What kind of rope is it?
I think it's a wide plank.
Okay, well, tell
and I hope it's a plank going into the ship as opposed to off the ship.
Should have said plank.
Now, Mr. Martin, tell us how you walk that plank.
Could I ask the Court to repeat the question?
To make it simple, on the one hand, if
got it.
You're looking at a 1985 determination of total disability versus a statute of limitations argument that may cut your claim. At a 1985 determination of total disability versus a statute of limitations argument that may cut your claims off.
Certainly. The key in this case is that he certainly could. One of the points the court, Your Honor, has made is, well, what about the fact that he didn't have a precipitating event? That's our very point. He didn't have a precipitating event. I'm not talking about the plane crash, but I'm talking about a precipitating event between the time of the plane crash and the time he sought disability benefits and filed suit in the late 90s. Because that supports the argument, in fact, that his disability, and Your Honor, it's not total disability that must commence before age 65. The policy says disability that commences prior to age 65. So his condition did, in fact, I believe the summary judgment evidence is, worsened to the fact that he, I believe the wording was, couldn't do it any longer. So he gets, at that point in time, he makes a determination to institute suit, file a claim, institute suit. Your Honor, we are not seeking any benefits, nor have we ever sought any benefits for any total or partial disability that went unpaid prior to the time that he filed his lawsuit. In fact, they had paid him total disability benefits for 2 years and stopped paying him total disability benefits, I believe, when he turned, I can't remember his age, but it was past 65. That's why I don't think it's a tightrope, that we're not seeking any benefits that the statute of limitations would be applicable to at all in this case, nor have we ever.
Let me ask you, you mentioned a moment ago that total disability is not income derivative, and so somebody who could be totally disabled and yet make a substantially larger income in the general area of the person's occupation. Where does that statement come from? Is that pursuant to your construction of the policy, or are there cases that you rely on?
It is pursuant to the policy itself. The policy has no, there's nothing in the definition of total disability that deals with income. There is, in a residual rider case, which is, or a partial disability case, there are income determinative. Thought this policy with the provision. Unable to perform, quote, the duties of your occupation, close quote. And I would like to point out, if I could, to the court. These three Texas Supreme Court cases, 1920, 1931, I believe, and 1961, those cases dealt with what actually used to be the language in Providence policy way back when, until change. They changed it twice, and it used to be that if you were unable, that the policy said you must be unable to, I believe it's to have to do any task in your gainful occupation. It used to be what the Bryant case and what the Tate case and what the Johnson case actually, I would use the term overruled as against public policy to have that type of language in the policy, because you would never be able to have a total disability claim. They, in two or three separate occasions, and they call it this, significantly improved the definition of total disability. They took that definition of total disability away. Now, I would make the argument that what they are trying to do is to get this court to submit or to insert a new policy, excuse me, to insert a new definition that goes back to essentially what the law was before 1920. And
questions?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I asked there were other questions.
I've got just one more, just a series here. Now, are you contending then that this insurance contract is ambiguous?
I am not contending it's ambiguous. I'm contending that its definition, it comports with what the Supreme Court on several occasions has indicated is the definition of what it means to be totally disabled. The duties of the occupation, as, and my time is up, but as set out previously in our briefing, and as set out previously in the definitions that the Supreme Court has given us in the past, is consistent with the new and improved definition that Provident gave Dr. Knott.
Well, under your argument then, could the parties ever come up with any contractual language to define total disability other than that contained in our common law?
I believe there is probably a I believe that the Supreme Court has outlined a good rule. I believe that there is language that could be constructed that's somewhat between what the new and improved definition in Providence policy is, the duties of your occupation, that they would like to read as all of the duties of your occupation, and what the Supreme Court back from 1920 has said is language that we can't live with. I believe there is a
so if this definition of total disability said unable to perform all duties of your occupation, you think then the parties would have contracted around the common law language?
I believe that that would be essentially the same language that the Supreme Court throughout the all of these years has said it can't live with. And I think the Supreme Court would have to change the law.
Disability then becomes a common law definition regardless of what the parties contract for.
That is what this court has done on three separate occasions, as outlined that is what the court has done in the past. So based upon that, I would say the court would have to do it in the future, but not for this definition and not in this case.
Do you think that's an appropriate method of construction?
If we had the old definition that
we have a contract that has specific wording to then import a common law definition into that contract that may not be consistent with the wording of the contract. Is that an appropriate way to construct?
I think it is appropriate in the circumstances that this very court has talked about in the past, that the Supreme Court has talked about in the past, where you've got a case where someone contracts for something that they really don't get a benefit from, which is what the court in Johnson said, the court, I believe, in Tate said, and the court in Bryant said, is you're contracting, you're getting paid money as an insurance company for a benefit that doesn't exist.
So it's an illusory contract.
That's what I would say. Those definitions are in fact illusory as far as anybody being able to get a total disability benefit in the state of Texas.
Is there anything in the record about the price differential for this? It's a rather rare occurrence to be totally disabled. Probably inexpensive to add. Is there anything in the record about the cost difference?
Yes, I believe, in fact, there is shortly before Provident gave Mr. Knott its bent over backwards and gave Mr. Knott its benefit of the residual rider, it was sending him advertisements for the residual rider, and it cost about $100 a year for the residual rider, which I would assume would be some evidence of an economic benefit of the residual rider that in this very case actually took away a benefit from Dr. Knott. And his total disability benefits, I can't remember the exact amount, but they were it's much higher to buy a total disability policy in this case than to buy a $100 residual disability rider.
I just have one more. I just want to make sure I understand your position on this. If the parties had a contract that said, we've adjusted our premium and taken this into account, this policy is going to have various levels of coverage, and we're going to define total disability very restrictively. You have to be completely incapable of doing anything. And we're going to define partial disability and residual disability. We're going to break these definitions down, and this is taken into account in the premium. In your opinion, would then the common law cases trump total disability definition there?
If the insurance company is getting paid for total disability, if they're giving the illusory benefit of total disability, or if they're giving a benefit and it's to be determined and it is in fact not going to be an illusory benefit, then the Supreme Court has to stick with the language. Okay, I misunderstood.
Posit the contract that says total disabilities, you can't do anything.
Okay.
Partial disability is something less. Residual disability is something less.
Right.
We've broken this down. We've taken it into account in the premium. This is our agreement. In your opinion, total disability would still be bound to the common law definition. Yes or no?
I just have to, when you say this, it's less, you mean less money to buy it?
Yeah, no, the contract just says this has been taken into account in the
sure.
in the policy payment.
Okay. I believe that in fact is done in this case. I believe in fact you pay more for something with a residual disability and a total disability.
So I just want to make sure your answer is yes, the common law definition would usurp.
Yes, it would.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ready to hear rebuttal.
Mr. Whitaker, isn't it true that neither your client's position nor Dr. Nutt's position on the definition of total disability is stated explicitly in this contract? Neither one is stated explicitly in this contract.
Well, I believe ours is, Your Honor. I think to the extent adding the word all of, you know, would be another way to write that to make it.
But all of is not in your,
I agree,
in your policy provision.
I agree completely.
So then we're going to have to look at something and follow some appropriate statute or contract interpretation tenets to figure out in the context of this contract which definition, which position, or some other position is right and just and appropriate. What is it we should look to and follow in your opinion?
We cite the court to the Roush opinion, Northern District of Texas, Judge Lindsay. Judge Lindsay faced a similar situation, interplay between total and partial. He said because duties is plural, it implies you're unable to do more than one duty if it's just analyzed in a vacuum. And then he said further support for that conclusion is found in the definition of partial, which covers the inability to cover one or more. I think Provident, and not Dr. Knott, and not the Court of Appeals, is the only party that can actually give meaning to both the definitions of total disability and partial disability and read them in such a way as to give meaning to all the terms. This court has, in a series of cases that we cited in the briefing, set forth standards of construction to follow in contract cases. And they include, among other things, giving meaning to all the terms, not reading out any part of the definition, and only reaching public policy grounds once you have examined the contract to see what result yields.
Let me ask you that. So you're distinguishing the old common law cases, the old Texas Supreme Court cases, based on policy language that contains a definition of partial disability.
Among other reasons, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
So if this were only a total disability policy, would you agree that the definition in the old Supreme Court cases applies?
I would not, Your Honor. I think
we would have to overrule those cases to go your way.
Well, I don't think so necessarily, Your Honor, because those were any occupation policies. And so they cover a different, using different language, okay? And I think that the notion that there is this body of insurance out there, disability insurance, that should have the wholesale importation of this common law definition into it, even though that's not done in life, auto, health, any of the other cases that this court has recently decided and articulated these standards of construction, I'm at somewhat of a loss to understand why disability insurance should be treated differently than all those other types of insurance where we just wholesale rewrite the language.
You don't have to rewrite the language. If partial disability is the inability to perform one or more of the duties of the office, and total disability is to be unable to perform the duties of the occupation, the duties of the occupation doesn't necessarily mean all, but it certainly implies a substantial number of the duties to the point that you can't adequately perform the occupation. So, I mean, the duties of the office doesn't say all the duties, but it certainly implies a number of duties that you can't perform. It wouldn't be totally inconsistent for the court to say total disability is the substantial inability to perform the duties of the office. It's not inconsistent with that language.
Well, I would think, Your Honor, on these facts, the same result may be reached. That is, because Dr. Knott is only unable to perform certain types of surgeries, that as a matter of law, that does not constitute a substantial part. And so in some circumstances, you could get to the same result. My problem with this, Your Honor, and I think it's something that Justice Smith was and Justice O'Neill were focusing on earlier, is there are different policies out there in the marketplace today. at different premium rates, which have presumably, if Texas law is being complied with, have been submitted to the Texas Department of Insurance for either approval or the opportunity to disapprove, and which probably didn't exist because it was created in 1951, didn't exist back at the time of those earlier policies that the court, on the earlier opinions that the court issued. And if the Court of Appeals and Dr. Knott are correct, it doesn't matter what those other total disability policies say in its total disability clause. It doesn't matter what rates have been charged. So I think if the Court of Appeals is correct, what the smart consumer should do is go find the cheapest policy that has the most difficult to meet definition of total disability and is priced accordingly, armed with the knowledge that, as a matter of cases decided, you know, a long time ago, all of those are automatically rewritten to include a definition that is much more favorable to him. And I think that that notion is just completely inconsistent with all of the recent opinions of this court in the insurance area, giving meaning, at least taking a look at and seeing if you can reconcile and make sense of the definitions themselves.
Do you have a question about, I assume you wouldn't deny that this provision basically lacks clarity and or specificity? So to the extent it lacks clarity or it's not specific, should it be construed in favor of the doctrine?
I think that the doctrine the court's referring to of contra preferentum isn't reached until the court has made the threshold determination that ambiguity exists. And in order for ambiguity to exist, there have to be two reasonable interpretations offered. To date, I don't think either Dr. Knott or the Court of Appeals have offered an alternative explanation for how total and partial disability can be read in conjunction. Instead, the Court of Appeals' position is just it should be rewritten in toto. So I don't think we have a situation, Your Honor, of...
It lacks clarity or that it lacks specific...
I think whenever you read...
That it's ambiguous in any...
I think that argument has not been raised by anybody to date, and then I don't think whenever those definitions are read in conjunction with one another, which, by the way, Dr. Knott applied for partial disability at the time. I mean, he was able to see back at the time what partial disability would cover, and he applied for and obtained a policy that said he would be partially disabled if he were unable to perform one or more, but not all, important daily business duties, and that was from the get-go.
You're saying his initial application before the 90 days had run, that you turned down because of that, was merely for partial?
No, Your Honor. The point I'm making is back in 1970 and 1974, when he applied for coverage, we added the residual later. I'll grant Dr. Knott that. But he applied for partial coverage, paid an extra premium for partial coverage, and knew when he got the policy that that would cover him against the inability to perform one or more, but not all, important daily business duties.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Well, it's been an honor for the court to sit today in Hillsboro. This is the first time we have ever sat in a trial court, even as a Supreme Court, even though six of us were trial judges at one point in our career. As I sat here and looked at the history of the court, I was reminded that two justices who served on our court were earlier in their careers district judges here in the 66th District, Nelson Phillips, who went on to be Chief Justice, and Sam Johnson, who worked at our court and then served on the Fifth Circuit United States Court of Appeals. And Ms. Johnson is here today. June, we're delighted to see you. Also, this courthouse is very important to the state because the tragedy of its burning and then its rebirth started great public interest all across Texas in our courthouses and in preserving these courthouses. And we're here really at the first of the great restoration projects. And so while we're saddened by the fact that until the budget condition of the state of Texas improves, we will not be visiting any other locations outside of Austin, we're certainly delighted to have been here today and to have heard this argument. And after a brief recess and some photos, we will look forward to visiting with the students about the justice system in our state. That concludes the arguments today, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.